Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, amid more violence in Israel, some are asking, where is the Bush administration?
The World Trade Organization meets in Mexico on the hundreds of billions of dollars in U.S. and European farm subsidies.
In Alabama, voters' rejection of a tax increase could lead to a four-day school week and prisoner releases to save money.
And the other 9/11, 30 years ago in Chile. New documents on the overthrow of President Salvador Allende.
And out of that meeting, CIA officials emerged believing that Kissinger had instructed them yet again to do everything in their power to keep Allende from actually being inaugurated as president.
Also, packing better school lunches for America's overweight kids.
These stories and more coming up here and now.
News is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Palestinian Parliamentary Speaker Ahmed Kouraya today accepted Palestinian President Yasser Arafat's nomination to become prime minister. Kouraya replaces Mahmoud Abbas. He says he will move quickly to form a cabinet. From Jerusalem, NPR's Julie McCarthy has more.
Ahmed Kouraya's announcement ends days of disarray that has gripped the Palestinian leadership following the resignation of Mahmoud Abbas. Abbas stepped down in part over what he called Washington's refusal to exert influence on Israel, to end its military aggression, and to implement its commitments under the American-backed roadmap for peace. It is not clear whether Kouraya has received the guarantees of support he sought from the U.S. He made no mention of them today. His decision to accept the premiership may have been impelled by the events of the past 24 hours. Two suicide bombings have left 15 Israelis dead, and an Israeli missile attack on the home of a Hamas leader in Gaza has killed at least two, leveled the house, and injured dozens more. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Jerusalem.
A U.S. soldier has died in Baghdad. He was trying to blow up a roadside bomb as a member of an ordnance detonating team. Another soldier was killed yesterday and a second wounded when a bomb went off near their vehicle on a road north of Baghdad. Meanwhile, a car bombing in northern Iraq has killed an Iraqi child and the attacker. Dozens of people were wounded, including six Americans. This bomb went off outside a building used by U.S. intelligence officials. NPR's Ivan Watson reports this is the first such attack in the Kurdish-controlled region.
Security for American officials and troops in the northern region was much less intense than in the rest of Iraq. American troops could walk around without helmets, without flak jackets. In fact, there had been a rest and recreation center set up in the north for American troops coming out of more turbulent central Iraq to get a break. This territory was also guarded by native Kurdish forces, militia fighters, as well as police. So it was much more stable, and this is the first real attack we've seen since the war on such a scale, indicating that no part of Iraq is truly safe at this time.
NPR's Ivan Watson in Baghdad. The Senate has voted to stop the Bush administration from cutting overtime pay for white-collar workers. The administration wanted these new rules about overtime to take effect early next year. The House has already approved them, but now the Senate's rejected them. The overtime rule's fate is uncertain. House and Senate negotiators will have to work out their disagreement. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 43 points at 94.63 in active trading. The Nasdaq down 30 at 18.43. The S&P down 6 at 1,016. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, Mexican authorities are bracing for huge protests today in Cancun. That's where trade ministers from 146 countries are gathered for a meeting of the World Trade Organization. NPR's Jerry Haddon reports from Cancun.
The WTO is meeting at this beach resort to try to make progress in stalled negotiations towards a global free trade agreement. At issue this round is agriculture. WTO members are searching for ways to eliminate subsidies and protective tariffs on farm goods. But protesters say liberalized trade will further impoverish developing nations who cannot compete with the large-scale agribusiness from Europe, the U.S., and elsewhere. Thousands plan to try to march to the WTO meeting hall here, though access has been blocked by thousands of Mexican security forces. Since violent outbreaks at the WTO meeting in Seattle in 1999, protesters have been a force that negotiators have found hard to ignore. The WTO says a global deal on trade will benefit millions of people worldwide by making consumer products cheaper. Jerry Haddon, NPR News, Cancun, Mexico.
Another senior Enron official has pleaded guilty to a federal charge in connection with Enron's bankruptcy. Former Enron treasurer Ben Glisson pleaded guilty to a single count of conspiracy. He's been sentenced to 5 years in prison. The Bush administration wants to transfer control of mortgage companies Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Currently, they're overseen by the Housing and Urban Development Agency. The White House plan would move them to the Treasury Department, and it would give Treasury greater authority over them. Freddie Mac was sharply criticized this year after accounting problems at the agencies were disclosed and federal agencies then investigated. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Amundsen Foundation for support of the NPR Endowment, helping to ensure NPR's financial future.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Israel today retaliated for yesterday's two suicide bomb attacks by leveling the home of a senior Hamas leader, killing his son and a bodyguard. Hamas has claimed responsibility for yesterday's attacks, which killed at least 15. More on that in a moment. But first to Washington. Robin Wright is the chief diplomatic correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. She joins us from Washington, D.C. And Robin, is there any indication that the Bush administration is going to try to revive this roadmap to peace, or, you know, whether they're going to have to start from scratch?
Well, the administration today is taking a firm line in support of the roadmap. It's reserving its judgment, however, on the new Palestinian prime minister. It's called on him to take some very decisive action to not only stand against the extremist groups, but also to dismantle them. And the administration at this point is going to base its final verdict on the new Palestinian leadership, on the cabinet he forms, a process that could take 3, even 5 weeks.
Now, when you say administration, do you mean the White House? And are you getting different messages from different parts of government?
One of the most interesting things is that the State Department language today talks about the administration being committed to the roadmap. But the White House is talking about the commitment to the president's vision, referring to his June 24th speech last year, in which he outlined a vision for a Palestinian state. So you could probably argue that there may be a little wiggle room emerging within the administration. But if, in fact, the Palestinians form a cabinet that's acceptable and looks appeared to reform with among the Palestinians and to take a firm stand on terrorism, then I suspect the administration will finally condone his appointment. Mm.
And what part of the roadmap are people referring to when they say they're going to stick to the roadmap? It would seem to be in tatters.
Well, it would, and I think one of the pressing issues for the administration is the looming deadline. There is supposed to be, by the end of this year, the formation of a temporary Palestinian state. And, of course, that looks ever more elusive because an awful lot is supposed to be done before that can happen. And once you begin to slip the time frame of the roadmap, that then moves everything further down, and there are real questions in this city about whether the roadmap is about to become roadkill.
And both sides in the conflict showing no signs of abating. Hamas, for instance, announcing that they now would broaden their attacks to high-rises and homes in Israel.
Well, there is a grave danger that the two parties are now engaged in an escalating cycle of violence, getting bloodier than it's ever been before. The administration is hoping that the bloodletting will eventually lead both sides to be exhausted and get them back to the peace process, because they will recognize, as the rest of the world does, that there is no way through violence to settle their problem.
And briefly, Robin, this roadmap was originally sponsored by the U.S., but along with the EU, Russia, and the UN. What's happening on the diplomatic front?
Well, the administration expects there to be major talks at the opening of the UN General Assembly between September 22nd and 26th. But it is possible that Secretary Powell, during his mission to Geneva to talk about Iraq with the other permanent members of the Security Council, could bring up the roadmap and what to do about the Israeli-Palestinian crisis.
Robin Wright, thank you.
Thank you.
Robin Wright, Chief Diplomatic Correspondent with the L.A. Times, speaking to us from Washington, D.C.
Among the victims of the latest violence in Israel was a man who devoted his life to victims of violence. He was head of a Jerusalem hospital emergency room, Dr. David Applebaum. We're joined now from Jerusalem by Nadav Shragai of the Haaretz newspaper. Welcome, Nadav.
Hello to you.
Nadav, tell me about Dr. David Applebaum.
He was a very special man and a doctor. He was a specialist in urgent medical. And just a few days ago, he lectured in New York in front of doctors from hospitals of New York University about treating wounded people in emergency situations and how Jerusalem deals with terrorist acts. He was a doctor and a rabbi. He knew how to talk to people, to patients.
Nadav, tell us how Dr. David Applebaum ended up at Cafe Hillel in the German colony in Jerusalem. How did he end up there, and who was he with?
He was sitting there with his daughter, Nava, his daughter that was going to get married this night. It was a father-daughter talk. Before the daughter was going to get married, and then the terrorist got into the cafe and bombed himself.
She was one of his six children and would have been married today.
Today, yes.
Dr. Applebaum had seen so much. He was head of a Jerusalem hospital emergency room.
Yes, in Shaarei Tzedek. He was a specialist in urgent medicine, one of the few here in Israel. And in his job, he saw many wounded people from terrorist acts, took care of Jews and Arabs, patients and wounded people in terrorist acts. Yesterday, I was in Shaarei Tzedek when they got the bad news. His family came there, his children. It was very sad. The doctors and the nurses had to take her and keep on, although they knew that their boss, Dr. Applebaum, was not coming and he was dead. And they were treating the patients and the wounded people from the terrorist acts, treating the patients and crying.
Nadav, so much suffering, mayhem in Israel still. Has the death of Dr. David Applebaum hit Israelis more profoundly than another death might have?
In his funeral today, you could see thousands of people from all kind of people, religious, unreligious, young people and old people who he treated them through over the years. He wasn't dealing with politics and things like that. He was dealing with people, and this was his greatness.
Nadav Shragai, thank you very much for joining us on this story.
Thank you.
Nadav Shragai of the Haaretz newspaper. A four-day school week and the release of thousands of inmates from prison. These are just two of the budget cuts Alabama officials are considering now that voters have overwhelmingly rejected a plan to raise taxes. Republican Governor Bob Riley outraged many in his own party with his plan to tax the wealthy more and the poor less to close a massive budget deficit. Riley also polarized voters with appeals to their Christian charity. Reporter Melanie Peebles joins us now from Birmingham, Alabama. Melanie, a big defeat for the governor.
Oh, it was. I mean, the voters were very clear about what they were telling him. They don't want to pay any higher taxes until they see the Alabama government shrink. They want more accountability. They want smaller government, and they're not even going to think about changing taxes until something like that happens.
Yeah, well, smaller government. What about four-day school weeks and releasing as many as 5,000 people from prison?
That's right. I mean, if you're talking about schools, I mean, they have to do something right now. They can't release those teachers because of the contracts for this year have been signed. So they're going to have to cut back on textbooks and teacher supplies, professional development, which is always a hot issue here. I mean, we want to make sure our teachers know enough to be teaching. And in terms of the prison, we are already shipping prisoners out of state. I don't know where they're going to make these cuts, but there's some huge cuts to be made because Alabama has a $675 million budget shortfall.
What do you make of the fact that there was such low support among blacks and lower income voters who, you know, presumably would have benefited from the plan?
Right. The only answer to that is that they must not have believed that it was true. I mean, we're talking about taxes and you're going to help me out. Yeah, it just had to have been a credibility issue, perhaps. The governor worked hard to get his message out, but I think it just sounds too good to be true.
You know, the governor's a Christian, as you know, and made a strong appeal to people's religious sensibilities, that this was the right thing to do.
That's right.
Did Christians go along with him?
Some did, some didn't. It's an issue that split Christians in Alabama. I mean, there were those in the camp who said that this is the moral thing to do. This is the Christian thing to do. This is what Jesus would have wanted us to do, is to lift some of the tax burden off the poor. And then there were the Christians who said, you know, Jesus wouldn't want me to be taxed more. It's immoral for you to raise my taxes up this high. It split the Christian coalition. We had the Christian Coalition of Alabama, who opposed the tax vote, and then the Christian Coalition of America said, hold on, we think this is a great idea. I mean, the way that Alabama's been taxing its poor and is going to continue to do it is a family of four starts paying state taxes at $4,600. I mean, that's the lowest threshold in the nation. Even Mississippi, it's almost $20,000 before a family of four starts paying taxes.
How's the governor faring? How is he reacting to this?
Well, it's interesting. When he came out last night, he didn't look like a man who was beaten. I mean, he has taken some beatings in the last 3 months over this. And he came out, he made it clear he heard what the Alabama voters had said. And from the way he sounded, you would have thought he'd just been elected, because he immediately turned around and said, I know you want things to get better, and we're going to work together. And he immediately started coalition building.
Well, Melanie Peebles, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Reporter Melanie Peebles spoke to us from Birmingham, Alabama.
And this note, Edward Teller died yesterday, a passing sure to provoke passionate response. Edward Teller was once asked if he was the famous Dr. Teller, father of the hydrogen bomb. Teller replied, I am the infamous Dr. Teller.
Edward Teller did more harm than any other scientist of the 20th century.
Russian studies expert Priscilla McMillan speaking of Edward Teller. Teller embraced the hydrogen bomb project so fiercely that he became the model for Dr. Strangelove, the title character in the 1964 film. Robert Oppenheimer, father of the atomic bomb, was, like most scientists of the day, against the creation of Teller's hydrogen superbomb. Later, Teller implied that Oppenheimer might be a security risk, which kept Oppenheimer from gaining national security clearance and infuriated the scientific community. But Teller was a Jew who fled the Nazis and experienced communism in his native Hungary, and he was embraced by those who shared his fear of the Soviet Union. Here he is speaking in 1961 about defending the United States against Soviet military might.
In my main day-to-day work and my purpose in talking to you is to make a little contribution toward finding and developing an other and a reasonable alternative. My main purpose is find a way in which we can have peace and in which we can preserve our freedom.
Edward Teller was 95. He died in his home in California.
September 11th is the 30th anniversary of the military coup that overthrew Salvador Allende in Chile. We'll look at the American role in the coup with author Peter Kornbluh.
That's just ahead. And later in the program, how does a farm subsidy in the U.S. affect a farmer in Ethiopia?
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
There was another 9/11 that shattered another country, an event that resounded around the world. September 11th, 1973, in Chile, when the Chilean military overthrew the elected government of leftist President Salvador Allende, who died in the coup. This week, that is the second anniversary of the 9/11 we all remember, is the 30th anniversary of what happened in Chile. We're joined now by Peter Kornbluh. He's author of the new book, The Pinochet File. He's made extensive use of national security documents to illuminate U.S. efforts in Chile to overthrow Allende and replace him with a military dictator. Welcome, Peter.
It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Thanks, Peter. You know, Americans and people all over the world grappling with so much really turmoil right now in the wake of September 11th, 2001. Why is it important on this anniversary week to also remember what happened on September 11th, 1973 in Chile?
I think there are two reasons. One is that the debates over U.S. foreign policy today, the debate over the use of preemptive strikes, the regime change, U.S. intervention abroad, morality in U.S. foreign policy, those are issues that we debated before, and we debated them over Chile in the mid-1970s. The second reason is that Chile remains a blight on the history of U.S. foreign policy. As the Bush administration prepared to invade Iraq last spring, Secretary of State Colin Powell was asked about this issue. He was asked about how the United States could kind of present itself as a moral interventionist force, given what it had done in Chile. And he said, you know, Chile, the 1970s, this is not a part of our country's history that we are proud of. And that was an extraordinary concession by the Secretary of State.
Peter, the book is called The Pinochet File. Just to be crystal clear for all of our listeners, who is Pinochet?
General Augusto Pinochet was the head of the Chilean military. He led a coup on September 11, 1973 that overthrew and left dead the democratically elected president of Salvador Allende. He became the dictator of Chile, ruled for 17 years. His name is widely believed to be synonymous with gross violations of human rights, and he really is one of Latin America's most infamous and recognizable dictators.
Although it should be pointed out that some Chileans still revere him. Peter, some of the language in these documents is still, even now, and we've learned a lot over the past 30 years about all sorts of things, it's still surprising language. Take one example from a classified document here. The key is psych war within Chile. We cannot endeavor to ignite the world if Chile itself is a placid lake. The fuel for the fire must come from within Chile, and so on. These are U.S. CIA agents writing about overthrowing another country.
That's what's so great about having the declassified record. You don't have to really take my opinion or my assessment. The documents allow you to not only read the conversations and meetings, but to read the blueprints that the CIA headquarters sent down to the CIA station to read how covert operations were run and understand in some ways how insidious they were.
Peter, of the many documents in this book, let's look at one which embodies the tone of many of the documents, particularly from the early 70s, a secret cable on October 16, 1970, soon after Allende's election, from CIA headquarters to the Santiago station. I quote, "It is firm and continuing policy that Allende be overthrown by a coup." This is right after Allende's election.
What this document actually is the result of a meeting between high CIA officials and Henry Kissinger the day before. And out of that meeting, CIA officials emerged believing that Kissinger had instructed them yet again to do everything in their power to keep Allende from actually being inaugurated as president after he had been elected several weeks before.
Yeah.
Propaganda, disinformation, planting false stories, planting information that untruthfully makes some particular person look bad.
Much moral certitude in these documents, but there's dissent too, isn't there?
Well, I think there are echoes of the current debate and the debate that our country went through over the last year, leading up to the invasion of Iraq. And you have, in these declassified memos, you have dissent papers, you have protest memos, you have arguments. You have Kissinger's deputy, for example, the day before Nixon ordered the CIA into Chile, writing to Kissinger and saying, what you're proposing is a violation of the principles and tenets of the United States of America, and we depart from those principles only when our survival is truly at stake. Can one argue that Allende represents a threat to our survival? It is hard to argue that. And so you can read those memos, but that only in some ways enhances the extraordinary nature of the policies that were undertaken.
Peter, eventually the United States government did become disillusioned with General Pinochet.
Well, after years and years of Pinochet's atrocities, and frankly after he had misinterpreted the embrace of the United States to the point where he felt he could send his aides to Washington, D.C. to commit an act of international terrorism, and I'm talking about the car bombing assassination of Allende's former ambassador Orlando Letelier and an American colleague Ronnie Carpin Moffat on September 21, 1976. That really became the turning point in some ways of U.S. Support for Pinochet. Here his agents had committed an egregious act of international terrorism right in the heart of our nation's capital. And by 1985-86, the Reagan administration had decided that Pinochet really should move on, should retire. The declassified documents tell a pretty interesting story of the Reagan administration's efforts in support of a massive popular movement in Chile to get rid of Pinochet, and how the administration helped blow the whistle on Pinochet's plan to abort a plebiscite in 1988 and stay in power.
The other 9/11 that will be remembered certainly all over South America, most passionately and intensely in Chile itself, but worth remembering, too, this week of 9/11. Peter Kornbluh, thank you very much for joining us on this.
You're more than welcome.
Peter Kornbluh is author of the new book, The Pinochet File, a declassified dossier on atrocity and accountability.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, the debate over farm subsidies as trade ministers meet in Mexico.
Poor farmers in developing countries are being swamped by subsidized crops and subsidized food that are putting them out of business.
And in the age of the overweight kid, packing a healthy lunch isn't the only problem.
In the average public school in the United States, lunch lasts between 8 and 12 minutes. In France, each kid has an hour for lunch.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. The U.S. Senate has voted against a Bush administration plan to rewrite the rules that govern overtime pay. Organized labor claims the new law will take away overtime eligibility for millions of workers. Republicans, including Senator Judd Gregg of New Hampshire, disagree, saying the number is more like 800,000.
They've been saying 8 million people will be affected by this in a negative way. That number is absolutely bogus.
Democrats, led by Iowa Senator Tom Harkin, mustered enough bipartisan support to defeat the measure 54 to 45.
The proposed rules that they've come out with really do wipe away the overtime pay protections for, I don't know, the figures are all over, but 8 million, 10 million, 7 million, 6 million, I don't know what the proper number is. But I can tell you, it wipes it out for millions of Americans.
The bill passed in the House earlier this year, so now congressional negotiators must work out the disagreement. The military wing of Hamas is threatening attacks on Israeli homes and high-rises in retaliation for an Israeli attempt to kill a Hamas leader in his Gaza home today. Israeli warplanes flattened the home of senior Hamas leader Mahmoud Zahar today, wounding him and his wife and killing his eldest son and a bodyguard in retaliation for twin suicide bombings that killed 15 Israelis yesterday. Meantime, Palestinian Parliament Speaker Ahmed Karaya accepted the job of Prime Minister today amid fears that a continued power vacuum will tempt Israel to intensify military strikes. Another U.S. soldier has died in Iraq, the second death of a U.S. serviceman in as many days. Military officials say the soldier from the 1st Armored Division was killed while trying to detonate a roadside bomb in Baghdad. The deaths follow an 8-day stretch in which no American soldiers were killed in Iraq. In the wake of the plagiarism scandal that rocked the New York Times, the paper has created a new position. Alan Siegel has been named Standards Director after leading the Times' internal investigation into the Jason Blair scandal. Siegel will oversee writing the new guidelines for using anonymous sources, bylines, and datelines. A national research group is calling for a broad new attack on teen drinking, and it says teenage drinking is a $53 billion problem in terms of traffic deaths, violent crimes, and academic failure. On Wall Street, stocks are lower, the Dow is down, so is the NASDAQ and the S&P.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
4,700 representatives from 146 nations begin a 5-day summit in Cancun, Mexico today as the World Trade Organization tries to move closer to an international agreement about agricultural subsidies, free trade, and tariffs. For the last 5 years, the annual summits have been a hotbed for protesters, including farmers, union leaders, and students, who argue that free trade rules benefit big business at the expense of poor nations and the environment. Joining us to discuss this year's meeting is Neil King, Jr. of the Wall Street Journal from Cancun. And hi, Neil.
Hello, Bill.
Neil, this year's meeting is supposed to build on agreements made at the last summit in Doha, Qatar. Is there a sense in Cancun that anything concrete will come out of the talks, particularly on that big looming question of agricultural subsidies?
Concrete is probably not exactly the word. I mean, what they want to try to get out of here is a consensus on exactly what they're going to move forward on and how. There's a lot of obscure words like frameworks and modalities, but essentially they want to come away, especially on the agricultural front, with the sense that the Europeans are going to be willing to slash further their subsidies to farmers, the Americans as well, and that there's going to be some degree of reciprocity on what is called market access by other countries, that is their willingness to lower tariffs on agriculture and also non-agricultural goods coming into their countries. But they're basically seeking a firm way that they can move forward on to try to seal this whole thing by the end of next year.
Yeah, Neil, this is an intermediate step in a continuing round, right? When does the round conclude?
Well, you know, the last round, which is called the Uruguay round, took 7 years to negotiate, almost eight. This one, they've been much more ambitious on the timetable. They've set a deadline at the end of next year. There's a lot of skepticism about whether they can do that, but that's still the timetable and that's still the effort.
Yeah, yeah. Tell us about the sense of Cancun today. Protesters, demonstrations?
Well, the Mexicans have gone to great lengths to assure that whatever ruckus making is going on at some distance. I mean, there's an extraordinary security presence here. The whole place is very well cordoned off, and most of the demonstrations so far have largely taken place in the city of Cancun itself, which is separated by a causeway from the whole sort of hotel zone where the convention itself is taking place. I think that the demonstrations, however, are much more likely to pick up going into, say, Friday.
Neil King, Jr., thanks a lot for joining us from Cancun.
It's a pleasure.
Neil King, Jr. of the Wall Street Journal from Cancun, Mexico.
Well, no issue at this week's meeting is likely to cause more debate than that of farm subsidies. While farmers in the U.S. and most of Europe say government subsidies help them maintain their production levels and stay in business, developing nations, China and parts of Africa, for instance, say they can't produce food as cheaply as American and European farmers who receive aid. Americans counter with demands that poorer countries drop trade tariffs and other barriers to U.S. products. They're asking for what they're calling more open markets. Well, joining us to talk about the WTO with agricultural issues is Ron Gaskill with the American Farm Bureau. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Ron.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Also, Gwen Kripke with Oxfam is in Cancun right now. Hi, Gwen.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Let's start with Ron first. From the American perspective, what do you hope to gain from the WTO meeting, and what are American farmers most concerned about?
Well, I think ultimately American farmers want to see at the end of the negotiation, whether it be in Cancun or whether it's finished, is a more level playing field. That includes reducing domestic subsidies as well as opening markets further to U.S. farm products.
And Gwen, your thoughts?
Well, we agree. We would like to see a level playing field, a market in which poor farmers can compete against rich farmers on a level playing field.
What would those you represent like to see?
Well, we argue that the field is so skewed against the poor right now that it's really not fair to ask them to make greater sacrifices. Currently, the rich countries are spending huge amounts on subsidies for their farmers, and poor farmers in developing countries are being swamped by subsidized crops and subsidized food that are putting them out of business. So it's a profoundly unfair playing field right now, and it needs reform even before we ask poor countries to make more sacrifices.
But, Gwen, American farmers are saying that their products run into trade barriers when they go into countries like, let's say, Africa. Describe a situation for us.
Well, to be clear, the United States uses trade barriers, too. When we feel like products are being dumped on the United States, say, from Mexico or other countries, we enact countervailing duties. Many of the poor countries don't have the ability to do that. Their farmers are being undercut by subsidized produce from Europe and the United States, and they're going out of business. And in Africa, it's not just a commercial issue. It's a survival issue for many farmers.
Well, Ron, why should a farmer, I'm just going to pull an example out of a New York Times article, a farmer who receives more than $336,000 from the U.S. government every 4 years, be able to sell his grain on the global marketplace and compete with, let's say, a poor, unsubsidized African farmer?
Well, and we think, in fact, that's an aspect that really does need to be changed. There's no question about that. If subsidies were eliminated today, clearly across the board, the state of farmers in developing countries isn't going to change overnight. I think it's wrong to think that the panacea is to eliminate subsidies. Farmers in developing countries already have a number of preferential tariff treatments that we give them, basically tariff-free to bring their products into this country. So certainly we need to focus on subsidies, but there are a number of internal structural things that developing countries as well need to do in order to really be able to compete effectively.
Well, Gwen, same question to you. Why throw the baby out with the bathwater? Sure, there might be overly subsidized farmers, but let's pick another example. The sheep herder in France, the last of his breed, why shouldn't he be subsidized by his government?
We're not saying that sheep herders in France or farmers in America shouldn't be able to make a living doing what they're doing. The problem is that the way subsidies are structured right now, they tend to go to the biggest and most efficient farmers. If it was small farmers who were benefiting, we wouldn't be as upset about the way the farm subsidies are playing out.
And, Gwen, there are some American farmers who'd say they'd gladly give up subsidies if there were no tariffs or barriers on the other side. In other words, if they could just sell their product free of any other costs.
That's part of what we're saying, is that there needs to be a better linkage between the subsidies and having an open market. That said, it has to be noted that American farmers make up something like 2% of the American population. In many developing countries, we're talking about 60, 70, 80% of the population are farmers. So a government in a developing country has to be very careful about drawing them open to the open market, because if they do that, we're talking about severe economic dislocation, increases in poverty, increased famine and hazards. So it's important to be careful and moderate in how you do that.
Well, to ask both of you, Ron Gaskell first, do you think anything's going to come of the WTO meeting?
Well, I think there's going to be some progress made, but the progress isn't going to be as substantial as we would have liked to have seen. Some of the specific details are going to be lacking and have to be subject to further negotiation. But I do expect that there will be a framework under which we'll at least make a major step forward. And, of course, every step is a step in the right direction.
Gwen?
I think the nations of the world are pretty committed to negotiating and talking here. But right now, things aren't moving very quickly in the right direction.
Well, I want to thank you both for talking to us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ron Gaskell of the American Farm Bureau speaking to us from Washington. Gwen Kripke of Oxfam International, who spoke to us from Cancun, Mexico.
Still to come, a new study shows school lunches contribute to obesity, so why not pack your own?
You're listening to Here and Now.
The European Union is considering adopting an initiative that would require U.S. chemical companies to test tens of thousands of their products currently sold in Europe for health and environmental hazards. The Wall Street Journal reports the Bush administration is lobbying intensely to prevent the new testing. Joining us on the line to discuss this is Journal reporter Thaddeus Herrick. And welcome, Thaddeus.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. What's at stake here? Why is the Bush administration apparently so concerned about this?
Well, the European Union represents a huge market, second largest economy in the world. And to the degree that the European Union can mandate regulatory policy with chemicals, the United States is going to have to fall in line. The American Chemistry Council says this is going to cost U.S. companies $8 billion over the next decade in direct testing. That may be high because ultimately I think that you would see consortiums of companies testing and thereby reducing costs. The other side is how much is this going to save in terms of health costs? And European commissioners there say, you know, over the next 30 years it could be, you know, $50 billion in various savings in terms of cancers and whatnot.
Well, are U.S. standards so different for chemicals than European standards? I mean, these chemicals must be legal, quite legal, and considered safe in the U.S., right?
The standards aren't different right now, but the U.S. policy is decidedly lax when it comes to chemicals, at least if you compare it to pharmaceuticals, for instance. I mean, we have a regulation that dates back to the 1970s, and under that regulation, there are 30,000 or so chemicals that are used in pretty high volumes that virtually go through very little, if any, testing. And surely many of these chemicals are not a problem. The issue is that, you know, from time and again, ones pop up, like PCBs, for instance, that are seen as potential carcinogens and show damage to the environment and to laboratory animals. And so the issue is, what are you going to do about how precautionary should you be, and what are you going to do about chemicals like that?
What do you think is going to happen?
I think that the ball is rolling in Europe, and Europe has adopted a sort of precautionary principle in terms of its law. And I think the best thing that the United States can do now is sort of chip away. But they are really rolling out the full force. They've got commerce, got the EPA, they've got State Department, in addition to U.S. industry and also industry from around the world fighting this. And so clearly the stakes for the Bush administration are very, very high.
On the other hand, the European Union's a player too, right? I mean, we're not... Perhaps in the past, we might have just said if one country had a problem, all right, well, we won't sell our chemicals there. But now you're dealing with a European Union, and that makes it a little trickier too, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at the discussions over genetically modified crops, for instance, I mean, it's again, there is this the world's second largest economy, the EU, standing up and saying, look, you know, these are the rules we want to play by. And the U.S., which, you know, obviously has sought a sort of go it alone sort of way of doing things under the Bush administration, is going to have to adapt to that as best it can. And the question is, you know, when push comes to shove, who will really prevail?
Thaddeus Herrick, thanks very much for joining us on this.
Thank you.
Thaddeus Herrick is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
First, some facts. Many children get half their daily food intake from their school lunch. And most schools now offer a la carte programs with alternatives like pizza that don't have to adhere to government nutritional standards, which a recent study finds many school lunches aren't adhering to anyway. The result, school lunch is one of the culprits in an increase in child obesity. New York City officials say half of that city's elementary school-age children are overweight or obese, and nationwide, the number of overweight kids has doubled in the last 10 years. So, what's a parent to do? Pack a lunch, but not just any lunch. Here in Now's food guru Scott Haas and resident chef Kathy Gunst are in our studio to talk about new trends for the lunchbox set. Hi, Scott and Kathy.
Hello, Robin.
Hey, Robin.
You know, what's for lunch? That's such a tough question, Kathy. You are a chef, but do even you have a sort of a reaction to it?
I detest it. I mean, my kids are now almost 13 and almost 16, and I don't pack their lunches anymore. But it is a chore that is best described as tedious. And, of course, you want to send them off. It's the one meal of the day that you don't watch them eat. So you want some sense that they're eating something that's halfway decent. And, of course, there's just huge problems with that because they're in a lunchroom with kids that are eating things that aren't particularly good for them.
They trade, Scott.
It's a real problem. In our household, the chores are who wants to do the kids' lunches or who wants to do the kitty litter.
I'd go for the kitty litter, right. And I'm allergic to cats.
Well, there you go. I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, but it's tough. You have some great suggestions, but let's talk also about some of the trends, Scott. I'm seeing more and more of people marketing to this need for school lunches.
They've been finding that there was a recent study reported in the Times that they're trying to put healthy things in vending machines. And the one thing that led kids to buy healthier things in vending machines, there was only one thing, and that was it was priced 5 cents less. People are responding to it. It's a health crisis. I mean, people are developing adult disorders in childhood and adolescence. It's not about just whether the food tastes good or is healthy. There's dramatic side effects, dramatic health side effects.
Right. Well, and now, Kathy, let's talk about, again, getting your child to eat what you pack. Anything that is just is not going to work.
Well, there's all kinds of things. They're not going to eat something they hate. It doesn't matter how much you tell them it's good for them, it's not going to get eaten. They just throw it into the trash or they trade. Mm. You have to start by saying, what would you like to eat for lunch? And then you have to say, fine, if you're going to bring that, then I want you to bring this too. But you have to get creative with it. Instead of making a sandwich the night before so that by the time the kid opens their lunchbox, it's this soggy, really detestable mess that nobody wants to pay attention to. You have to sort of think outside the box. You know, how about fruit salad with a skewer instead of, you know, this mush stuff in a cup that's prepared? The big issue that I see, I have actually had lunch in the school cafeteria at my daughter's junior high school, and they are eating these plastic TV dinner style trays. They're called Lunchables. And what they are processed foods in little packages. There's a little piece of processed meat, and there's a little piece of processed bread, and there's a little piece of processed dessert. There isn't a single real piece of food in these trays. And I would say that 8 out of 10 kids are eating those things.
Okay.
So what do you do with your kid who says, oh, but mom, she's got one and he's got one? Well, there now are organic alternatives to this available in health food stores. They are actually designed with cartoon characters on them. The health food companies are getting savvy that kids want this so-called cool stuff, and they're marketing to it, and it's well worth seeking out because it looks the same, but the food is real, and they pay attention to calories.
Scott, you're going to bring us a story down the road about Stonyfield Farms sort of reacting to this trend.
That's right. They've opened up 4 restaurants, and what they're doing is they're recognizing that it's going to take a long time for people to stop eating on the run. They're not trying to change people's habits, but they're saying if it's going to have to be fast food, it should be organic, it should be seasonal, it should be fairly priced, reasonably priced, and people are starting to go to them. And it's a wonderful alternative because they're not they recognize that it's just not going to change. People just grab whatever's on the road and they eat it. And mm-hmm. I would imagine this might catch on. I mean, the problem with organic and seasonal food is that it's expensive. I wonder how they're going to control costs.
Well, and when it's for your kids, I mean, let's face it, a lot of people are trying to put dinner on the table at night, and lunch can sometimes be a place where you cut corners.
I mean, sure, you cut corners, and you don't want to spend more. You know, it's so interesting also. In the average public school in the United States, I believe lunch lasts between 8 and 12 minutes. In France, each kid has an hour for lunch. And that's a huge philosophical statement about how this country views food and what our kids grow up with. Food you shove down your throat. You eat it as fast as you can. You get out to the playground as quickly as you can to hang out with your friends. Food's not important. Food's not something you linger over.
Okay, well, let's do something right now. You've got some brown bags here. Scott, we're going to start with you. And I know you want me to do a blind taste test
first. I do, in
fact. So I will.
I want you to close your eyes.
Okay, they are.
All right, your eyes are closed. I'm unwrapping the sandwich here, and
it is delicious. And one of the reasons I can't tell you about it is that it's got peanut butter in it, doesn't it?
Yes, in fact.
Is your mouth sticking together?
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a very simple, old-fashioned kind of guy in many ways. It's a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, but it's killer peanut butter.
It's real.
Well, it's peanut butter. I found out about this company that is now selling their peanut butter throughout supermarkets in the United States. It's called Peanut Butter and Company. It's from the East Village. I think it's the East Village. They have all different flavors. This is peanut butter blended with sweet white chocolate. And it's also with really great...
There goes the calories.
I know. No, what about calories?
Well, wait a second. It's also great black cherry Swiss jam. So you've got great jam, great peanut butter, and it plugs into the kids' inclination to eat peanut butter and jelly, but it's just really delicious. And in terms of the calories, it's so intense that you just don't need to eat a lot of it. That's something Kathy and I talk about from time to time. It matters what you eat, but also portion sizes matter a lot.
Because if you're eating a lot of stuff that just has nothing in it, has got no protein, you need to eat more
but
to feel satisfied.
But the point is
that's the Atkins
diet,
right?
Like, I won't buy no-fat sour cream, and I won't buy no-fat butter and cheese, because if you're going to eat these foods, eat them and enjoy them. You don't need to eat them excessively. The point is that you have this mouthful of flavor, and you become excited, and you don't need to eat excessively because you're satisfied. And this is something kids need to learn at an early age.
I'm looking at the peanut butter and jelly here. The fact is it's all natural.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at some of the processed foods that you have, if you compare peanut butters, the value of it is going to be huge.
Absolutely. But a peanut butter and jelly sandwich is actually a viable, old-fashioned alternative that most kids are going to like. My kids, for some reason, never liked peanut butter and jelly, so I brought an alternative.
But, I mean, do it right, though. This is a 10-grain bread from Vermont. If you're going to do it, get good ingredients. It's an ingredient-driven lunch.
Okay, Kathy,
I have got a lunch. This is something my kids always loved. It's a make-your-own taco. I've got a whole wheat tortilla here. And then I'm also very big into environmental stuff. I can't stand when they throw everything away. So I have little plastic containers. Here's some roast chicken from last night's dinner. Could be anything, really. Here's some salsa that's extremely fresh and low-fat. A tiny bit of sour cream. And you make your own tortilla in the lunchroom. Here's your tortilla. You spread it with what you want. You could do shredded lettuce, shredded tomato. My kids have always loved this. And other kids have always looked on very enviously because they're creating their lunch and it's fresh and all the ingredients are really healthy.
How great, though, that you give your child something to play with. Play with their food.
And you know that it's not going to be soggy. Another version of this is to sort of do your own salad bar in little containers. Do some chopped tomatoes. Do some shredded carrots. Kind of make it fun so that my kids love pitted black olives. But again, these are fun foods. They're not filled with fats. And if they make it right there in the lunchroom, it adds a sort of element of creativity to it. And it's not the bologna sandwich that your mom made last night or that was packaged by a corporate office 6 months ago and that gives you no nutrients. You have to unclasp the sides there.
It's childproof, Robin.
I want to give you both a chance while I'm making my little tortilla here. Just tick off some other ideas that people might not think of. Just jog some thinking about lunch substitutes.
Well, I like what Kathy said. I mean, I like the fact that she said that you need to involve the child in their lunch. You can't simply, as they get older especially, tell them what they're going to eat. It's also good, as she said, to make it fresh that morning. Leftovers from last night's dinner is a great
leftovers
idea.
Leftovers very popular at our house, too. They also love to bring soup in a thermos.
My tortilla just fell apart. This is a fabulous idea, make your own tortilla. One last tip, Kathy?
You know, something really important, like when you're packing these tortillas and you have chicken and sour cream, is put one of those little ice packs right into the lunchbox. They make them really small now, and it'll keep your kids' lunch cool for hours because they generally don't have access to refrigeration.
Mm. Well, I want to thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
Here now is resident chef and cookbook author Kathy Gunst and food guru Scott Haas.
Here now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Kudel, Emiko Tamagawa, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild's our engineer. He's assisted by Tim Skog and Boris Strapatsky. Our web producer is Zach Christo, and our interns are Ann Stevenson and Ed Walter.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again. Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories Here and Now.
As the nation marks the second anniversary of the September 11th attacks, we'll have a report from Ground Zero.
And a look at the Victims' Compensation Fund and why some families aren't taking part.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.